The Education Budget Division will come to order. And first bill we have is Senator Kubley, Senate File 2550. Morning and welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. I guess I can say that plural. You know, Senate File 2550 is a bill that, you know, just asked for a waiver from the penalty that's imposed for failing to finish up your contract by the 15th of January for those districts that negotiated in good faith and actually had had an agreement. I think, you know, I had looked at Education Minnesota's website. There were 24 districts in the state that were not settled by the deadline. But on the fiscal note, you'll notice that there are only two that qualified under the parameters of this bill. But with me today, Mr. Chair, is Superintendent Scheckman from Yellow Medicine East, and I'd like to have him kind of share the story of what happened with the committee.
Hey, thank you, Senator Kubley. Superintendent, if you could give your name for the record, please.
Good morning, Senator. Thank you for this opportunity to address the committee. I'm Alan Stockman, Superintendent for Yellow Medicine East Schools. I believe in your folder there is a handout that kind of summarizes a little bit of the demographics of Yellow Medicine East School District. It's located in West Central, South Central Minnesota. Gives a little background as far as our financial picture of the past few years. And then on the bottom, or starting in the middle of the page, it addresses the negotiation process for this past, or starting in 2009. In April, the teachers submitted their notice to negotiate. We began in May with negotiation sessions. The first one was laying out ground rules and so forth. And then, as you can see, in June, July, August, we continued to meet. We did not meet in September. It was a choice with the beginning of school and the commitments that are necessary for the beginning of school, not meeting in September, but we then in October and November continued to meet. Progress was made on language items. The financial piece was the holdup. The teachers did feel that not enough progress was being made, so that in November they petitioned for mediation services. We did then schedule a mediation session in December, on December 17th, with a mediator. That did not reach any agreement that evening. It just ended that with no agreement at all. It actually was a a short meeting. The teachers felt somewhat frustrated that progress wasn't being made. We thought, though, after the holiday winter break, I attempted to again meet with the negotiators without the mediator, and we did have a session on January 8th without the mediator, contacted the mediator to inform him that we were going to continue negotiations. On January 8th, we did reach a tentative agreement that was initialed by the teacher negotiators. On January 11th, at our regular board meeting, we closed the meeting and discussed the details of the tentative agreement. The board had originally wanted zero, hard freeze. The teachers were coming in at about an 8% increase. So the tentative agreement in MSBA, Minnesota School Boards Association calculation, was about a 2.8% increase, which would be about $2,000 per teacher over 2 years. That school board, again, some members were still adamant to stay with a zero, but during our closed session, there was consensus reached that they would approve, if the teachers would approve the tentative agreement, the board would also approve that tentative agreement. A couple days later, on January 13th, the teachers voted and, in their words, overwhelmingly rejected the tentative agreement and asked if we could meet again to meet the January 15th deadline. But at the school board session, the board felt that there would not be any more movement and there would be no need to attempt to meet again. So then the deadline passed. Since that time, we have held another negotiation session in February and planned for another one now this coming Monday. So we continue to negotiate. We have negotiated in good faith, but based on financial limitations and being fiscally prudent, the board felt that it was in the best interest maybe to absorb the penalty in the long run, and that's why now I'm requesting the possibility of waiving that this time, because we did negotiate in good faith. We did reach a tentative agreement with the negotiators, but the teachers' union as a whole voted down the tentative agreement.
So, Superintendent, I see as of March, you still don't have an agreement at this point.
That is correct, Chairman.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Superintendent Stuckman. What was the total dollar penalty then that the school would be assessed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, the total amount would be around $25,000, a little more than $25,000.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, I think that's on the fiscal note, too.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's on the second page, about a third of the way down.
How would this differ from the other districts that did not settle? Apart from, I guess you'd say you thought you had a tentative agreement. Do tentative agreements carry any weight?
Mr. Chair, we would hope that the negotiating team from the teachers would feel comfortable with it, even though it probably isn't what they had hoped for, would then have the opportunity to go back to their membership and try to convince them that this is the best settlement that could be reached at the time. It's not always accurate that it will get approved, but again, negotiating good faith and seeing the either side, it's hoped that a tentative agreement could be settled on or voted in favor of by the teachers.
Just wondering if this would open up the floodgates for all the districts that did not reach the settlement by that.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Cooley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, you notice on the bill that, it's fairly narrow. It does restrict it to those that had a collective bargaining agreement with which the teacher negotiators agreed, but then when it was taken to the faculty at large, it was not accepted. So, I guess, we did try to restrict it to those districts, and there are only two in the fiscal note, Mr. Chair, out of the 24 that didn't settle. So, I guess from our perspective, we tried to narrow it down to those that actually had an agreement before the deadline, but that was then later rejected.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Bonhoff and then Senator Scogin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kubley, sorry for missing the earlier part of your testimony. I, too, was asked to carry a bill for one of the metro districts that was in a similar situation. I've actually heard of many districts who have been in similar situations. I don't know if this one was in. What is the other one that you have listed in your 25?
It's Lacaparra Valley.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kubley, I know that same thing did happen, for example, with Edina. I think there are many districts that have had this situation.
Well, Ms. Chair and Senator Bond, if that may be, I guess, all I had to go on was, you know, the fiscal note that was put out. I'm not aware of where are the other districts. There were 24 districts statewide, according to the Education Minnesota website, but... You know, I'm not aware of where they were in their negotiation.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if this is for Superintendent Stuckman or the committee. If are we about to try to change the dynamics of negotiations by offering this as an option? I mean, I know it's one time. You thought you had an agreement. You certainly look like you had started early enough where if something had fallen apart, you would have had a second chance, but it kind of ran the clock out on you, and there you were at the deadline. But it still worries me a little bit that this may change the dynamics of future negotiations given this.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubli.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin. I guess... You know, historically, this is not the first time that a waiver would have been granted, should you grant this one. You know, it has been done in the past, so I think there is a precedent.
Do you remember? Does anyone, does the department, I think, usually the department gives us a list of the districts that are in statutory operating debt, but I don't think we've gotten that this year yet. Not sure. Have we? Okay. Dr. Melcher is here. Good morning.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. We do have that prepared. There have been some delays getting the official report out of the department, but we can provide you that data anytime.
Okay. That would be helpful. Thank you. Senator Saltzman first.
On these points, Mr. Chair, I think that it would be one thing to look at this as a one-time. I would think in the future, if this sets a precedent, it would be a way to get around, oh, yes, we have a tentative agreement, so we didn't have to pay the fee. But I think it does raise the issue that in these very difficult economic times, these, you know, negotiations are going to be more and more difficult. And people talk about, you know, changing some of the dynamics. I think we've talked about that at this table. I think Senator Hand talked about some ideas that, you know, in terms of the levy referendums and, you know, giving districts the authority to renew them during these times, to have the school board be able to vote to maintain a current levy might be an option, that there will be support for that. But at the same time then, all the stakeholders need to understand there might be some different rules regarding then, you know, negotiations, while also protecting the rights of, you know, our, you know, labor unions. But at the same time, I think that we're in a very uncharted waters here, and it's very troubling to hear that, you know, everyone's trying to come to the table. And, you know, as I've talked with people today, I'm going to go meet with some folks, and I've been told, does the public really understand how deep that our budget deficit is, you know, and the cuts that we're making across the board in so many areas, and then having school districts pay these fees when there are really good faith efforts. So it's very difficult. And maybe it's removing the January 15th deadline. Maybe it's making, you know, some other rules in place. So I am leaning toward this because I think it's a one time, but I would be very hesitant to look at this going into the future.
Okay. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, and I had a question for Dr. Melcher, or perhaps Mr. Nauman would know the answer, but do we have a list of school districts that haven't settled? Is that information made available to us?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, Dr. Melcher may want to comment on this. I asked that information from the department about a month ago, and I haven't followed up with them since, but at the time, the data was still being worked. So I'd have to go back and double check with the analyst that's doing the work and see where we're at.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff. This I took this list off Education Minnesota's website, but it's 2 months old now, so the districts that remain may not be this many, but it was 24 at that time.
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman, I'd have to back and double check with our office, but I know that for purposes of the February forecast, we did calculate the adjustment, so I know that we have the data. I don't know what the delay would be. I can check on that and get back to you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dr. Melcher, I would like to see that and any other detail around the settlements. Dr. Melcher, do you also get what the settlements actually are, what the percentages are for the districts?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonoff, no, we don't. There have been a number of requests for that, and I think part of the department bill is to have the department collect that information, but we don't currently receive that. I know that the School Board Association does do some of that, and at this time we rely on the School Board Association for information on what the settlements have been.
And, Mr. Chair?
Senator Bonoff.
Is it Dr. Steckman?
Mr. Stockman.
Mr. Steckman, thank you. Could you share, and maybe you already have, but what did you end up settling for? What were the terms of your settlement?
Mr. Chair.
Superintendent.
And by the way, I ask not just to be nosy, but we have been discussing around the table, just curious. We know it has been a very tough time for all of our districts and that everybody's having a hard time negotiating these contracts, and so I think it's illuminating for us to understand what actually is happening out in the field.
He did tell us.
Oh, he did. Okay. So
The board's position was zero hard fees. The teachers began at 8% increase. We did have a tentative agreement at 2.8%, which overall would have been about a $2,000 increase over the 2 years for each teacher.
Okay. Okay. We have any other questions that members have?
Make a motion.
I move the bill to be laid on the table, Mr. Chair. Senate File 2550 be laid on the table for possible inclusion.
Okay. And I just remind committee members that we'll try to get more information as to the impact that this might have on the number of districts and what that dollar amount would be. So, Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, and I know we've been talking a lot about, what the teacher contracts are and, having negotiated for over a dozen years. Sometimes when you look at a snapshot of one particular contract negotiation, doesn't really tell what kind of discussions were held 2 years before, 4 years before. And typically, we're going to help the district this year. We'll take a zero, a one, and based on the percentage increase in health care costs. So the next go around, maybe it's a makeup year. Maybe it's, districts can't keep falling behind their neighborhood schools. And so as we look at what is your contract settlement, well, they might have done a 0-0 and a 0-1 and a 0-2, and, hey, it's time for a 4, okay? If schools start to fall behind the other districts over time, they can't attract the best teachers. And so let's be careful about that one-shot snapshot of teacher settlement. We need to look at the long term, what the negotiations have been, and I just want you to keep that in mind as we go forward.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. That's some good information. On Senator Scogin's motion, anybody else that would like to comment? If not, all those in favor? Well, we have to wait until we have a quorum, so we'll hold that motion, Senator Scogin. Thank you, Senator Kubley and Superintendent Stockman.
Thank you, Mr. Sharon, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I see Senator Sharon is here. And I believe, Senator, you have an amendment. We will hand that amendment out. This is on Senate File 3079.
And there's a correction.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you.
And we love the kind of legislation that you bring to this committee.
This complicated, very complicated, right?
Well, you're saving us money. Or saving somebody money.
Saving somebody some money. We would be handing out the amendment, but we discovered a little error in it, so I'm going to have to make an author's oral amendment, if that's okay.
Okay. Senator Sharon?
The amendment I'd like to make is on page 1, line 11.
Is this on the bill or is this on the amendment?
This is the amendment to the bill.
Okay.
And I'll read it whenever you're ready.
Okay, Senator. Senator
Sharon.
Okay,
thank you. This is on page 1, line 11, after the period. Insert. The revenue billed to a student under this subdivision must be retained by the institution that provided the textbooks or equipment.
So, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I see.
The language that Senator Sharon spoke is in the amendment, with the exception of the fact that we just missed the word retained after must be on the amendment, line 1.3.
Okay.
So if the word retained is added orally to the amendment, I think it reflects her intent.
That's correct on the A1 amendment.
All right. Senator Sharon would just include in her A1 amendment after... on line 1.3 after B, insert retained. And if rather than getting new amendments printed up, since we don't have a quorum yet, we will, we will hold that. But, okay. All right, Senator Sharon, if you'd like to explain kind of what you're doing.
Thank you very much, Senator. I was licking my lips myself over the 60, even though it's not very much money. There's some money retained here. This is a simple bill that simply says that the committee may not know that the textbooks for the post-secondary enrollment option programs are provided by universities and institutions to the students at no charge. And if you have copies of the fiscal notes, you can see that there are assumptions about what the consequences of that are. That's about 60,000 of textbook equipment not returned by students in an academic year. And so what this bill does is allows the universities to bill the students for those textbooks or equipment within a period of time which would be defined by the institution themselves, and that the university would invoice the student for that textbook and equipments that are not promptly returned. And it's simply that so that the universities can regain some of the revenue from the textbooks that they've given out free so they can continue the process.
Okay. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum, and Senator Sharon... Senator Olson moves the A1 amendment with that change of inserting retained on line 1.3 after the word B. So on that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Sharon, is the tracking of these books not really monitored by the district? Or where do you think the problem comes up? If I understand you correctly, the students receive the books.
That's correct. I what your question asks me that I don't have an answer to is whether or not the university provides this textbooks to the K-12 institution, and then they're distributed accordingly there, or if the student gets those textbooks from the university itself. I don't I don't know the answer to that question.
It seems like, are we trying to address a problem that the university, let's say, I'll just say the Minsky system, but I'm sure it's probably true at the university as well. Are we trying to address a problem that is the Minsky's problem, or is it the student's problem, or is it the high school administration's problem?
Well, the fiscal impact is on the universities. So that is what makes this a university problem. The fiscal impact for the University of Minnesota is estimated at about $1,529 per student for textbooks and course materials if they're not returned. So the fiscal impact is on the higher education institutions.
Maybe I can try to rephrase my question. I'm trying to understand exactly what's happening here. Wouldn't the responsibility lie on the part of the higher education institution to get that book back, or the faculty of the higher education institution? Because the student is going to that, under the PSEO, they're going to the higher education institution, and let's say they're taking a calculus class or something, and this book that they had to purchase, well, actually the student doesn't have to purchase
it. That's the issue. The students are provided the textbooks for free. And it is a post-secondary institution, then, that will be responsible in this situation to bill the student's family for the textbooks and try to either get the textbook back or be able to receive some money back in order to continue to support the textbook system.
Okay, Mr. Nauman's going to help us.
So, Mr. Chairman, actually some of the operative language, I think, is in the bill under Subdivision 20. The way the PSEO works is that a student that enrolls in PSEO generates a percentage of the K-12 formulas for the higher ed institution. That money is passed along to the higher ed institution. And that higher institution would then use the funding to help pay for the textbooks and the equipment for the course. That the textbook and the equipment for the course is the property under the existing law of the higher ed institution. And I think what this bill appears to be addressing is the occasion where a student would retain, or maybe not return, the material that is the property of the higher ed institution. So then, under the language of the bill, the higher ed institution could bill for that, for material not returned.
Senator Rommel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, would the instructors be advising the students ahead of time that they will be billed for those books if they're not returned? Is there some kind of caveat to let the students know that they are responsible to return those?
Senator Brown, not the language in this bill is not that prescriptive or directive, but
in practice.
In practicality, I think that would be a logical thing to do, to not surprise somebody but I have not been that prescriptive or described that in the language of this bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
You know, maybe this wouldn't be very popular either, but maybe there needs to be some language that says that failure to return the textbook could jeopardize your receiving credit for the course.
Senator Rummel?
Or another idea, Mr. Chair, would be to have students make a deposit and they get the deposit back when they return the book.
Okay, it seems to be, we have ideas, Senator Wieger.
Mr. Chair and Senator Shern, is it the intent that this be possibly included in our E-12 omnibus bill, or ultimately that's where we're tracking? Then I had a few suggestions.
Okay. My guess is that we probably would, you know, if
the higher ed bill is closed,
okay.
The finance bill.
It would probably be in the omnibus K-12 bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, of course, it's on the floor where the Committee of the Whole could discuss that. But that said, I would suggest a few things, and I don't have the exact wording we could, but I just want to put it on the table thinking that we'll advance this for possible inclusion. One would be on the reference to textbooks and equipment. I know the current statute refers to that, but I think we might want to add coursework materials as well, because you know sometimes DVDs, there's other things that might be required that are issued, and that's more the word of art now. And so I would suggest that after textbooks to add coursework materials. And then in the actual statute itself, on line 1.7, you could include that, just as a consideration. And secondly, we say promptly return at line 1.11. We probably should tighten that. And I would suggest within 7 days of the last day of class or final exam, but so we know when that would occur. And then it probably should be clear too, where you return the text. A lot of times after the final exam, the teacher might be gone, or if you were going to bring it back, so maybe it's the bookstore, but it's just so the student knows where to bring the book in case it's not clear. So I would have those friendly suggestions with the intent that it's a very good idea, the bill, but to perhaps improve it.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Stumpf. Thank you, Senator Wicker, for those suggestions. Before you act on them, though, I would ask you to consider that it is the intent, it's in the language of the fiscal note, that there be flexibility in allowing the institutions to define in their communications around their programs what promptly is defined as, because there may be unique circumstances to each institution. And I also am very concerned that we not write too prescriptive a direction in the statute about where to return books, et cetera, because each of these institutions has different systems and processes about doing this. And I really do believe that if this is clarified, that those institutions, when doing their programs, will take advantage of this, and they'll send along with the books, you receive this book, is returned by this time, you are billed, and this is where books are returned. Right now, there must be a process for those students who are returning their books to return their books. So I'm just asking you to think about that again in terms of whether you want to, especially for such a diverse set of campuses that we have that are involved in this, that we not define here too clearly what their processes should be.
Senator Rowland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just reading this fiscal note here and really puzzled by the assumptions that tuition for a semester is $9,568. And that's a whole year's worth. And then the amount listed here for equipment and book materials is $1,529 per semester. And we have assumed throughout our discussions in higher ed that it's $500 a semester about for books. So that's three times greater in this fiscal note than what is the reality. And so I'm puzzled by the information we have in the fiscal note. But I do think it is a big deal. And textbooks can cost, a science textbook can cost $125, $130. I do think that they should be returning them for use by another student in the future. And whether it saves their home district money or the higher ed institution, I think that we should be able to recapture those unless those students choose to buy them if they're part of their major or something. But then that's their choice if they want to purchase them.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Roebling. I think, I don't know who's chairing, Senator Wicker.
Yes.
Senator Roebling, I agree. I think that there was a rare occasion in college where I wanted to keep my textbooks or my materials. That's not really true. And for nursing courses, I kept many. But so I don't want it to be so prescriptive that a person couldn't purchase the materials if they wanted to. It's just that the current system does not require a return or a payment for those. And I don't think we can afford to do that, even if it's $50 or $30, whatever the fiscal note says. And I also really believe that part of what you struggle with all the time here is responsible behavior. And high school students need to start to think about that this book isn't free. This book does cost somebody something. And there's a responsibility that comes with my receiving it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree with that. But think of the job of trying to collect this. These kids go on. You've set up a process that costs money, too. How successful will it be? You may not be able to track them down. I still think that if we had in the statute that failure to return them, your credit will not be, for the course, will not be granted until the materials are returned, I think would get their attention. I mean, why are they taking the post-secondary enrollment options in the first place? They're getting both high school credit and college credit. That's significant. And this says this is important for you to be responsible. Return it or you don't get the credit. And I think that'll take care of it then instead of having to chase down somebody after the fact.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Olson, I think we might want to say return it or pay for it. Some may choose to.
Well, that's fine.
To keep the book.
That's fine. But the count should be settled before they're gone or before the credit is granted, because I think the higher ed institution needs a little bit of a club there rather than to have to spend more money to chase this, either the book or the money.
Dr. McQuay.
Mr. Chair and members, Subdivision 19 prohibits a secondary, post-secondary institution from charging, but it allows an exception for equipment purchased by the pupil that becomes the property of the pupil. So in the situation where a student wants to keep the book, that is allowed under Subdivision 19, and they can pay for it at that time.
Further comments, discussion? It's Senator Stump's recommendation that this bill would go to finance, would not be a part of our omnibus bill at this point there, but that it go directly, because we wouldn't book, you know, savings within our own division on this, or it wouldn't be reflected. And Mr. Nauman, if there's any, you know, further direction on this in Senator Stump's absence, otherwise I believe we've given some suggestions to the author, perhaps some forthcoming language that we don't have perfected here, but could address at a future time when we're a committee of the whole on the floor.
Mr. Chair, from a financial perspective, I think that Senator Stump's thinking was this is not bookable savings on the part of the K-12 or E-12 division, but it is an E-12 statute. So this division clearly has some ability to make some adjustments and changes to this, but in terms of a financial tracking, it would be easier for the Finance Committee to sort out where the money falls with respect to the total general fund. And I think that's why he was recommending that.
Okay. Further questions, comments? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to address the committee on this? Okay, and I'll note Senator Bonoff and myself, as well as Senator Roebling, we're working on textbook language pricing as well, on an issue that came up, as you're aware, Senator Sharon, in the Higher Ed Committee, and disclosures that are made. So perhaps this will intersect with a meeting that a few of us are going to be at tomorrow, and I'll let you be aware of that at 9 o'clock if you'd like to attend. That said, we'll entertain a motion. Senator Bonoff moves that Senate File 3079 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. Further discussion? If not, all in favor indicate aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you, Sandra Schern. Are there any non-committee authors in the audience that are prepared? If not, Senator Saltzman. Yeah, before us, Senate File 2384, Referendum Equalizing Factor Increased. And there's an amendment, and Senator Saltzman will distribute that now.
Yes, I'd like to have
that'll be an author's amendment.
Yes, there's an author's amendment. And is it A1?
It's in the packet. It's A1. And again, this is an author's amendment. Senator Saltzman moves the A1 amendment. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Saltzman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm here today with Senate File Number 2384. It is to increase equalization. And there is a number of handouts in your packets that look very technical, but one is labeled the opportunity gap, and one has a run of all the districts. And I want you to think about the fact that over time, as we've turned what used to be called excess, an excess levy, into an operating levy, it used to be for some of the extras. And increasingly, school districts are really relying on these operating levies in order to fund what many believe is really a basic education. Can you imagine that if a school district wants to go out and perhaps add all-day kindergarten, or they want to be able to expand courses for students, or they want to invest in greater staff development, or they want to be able to do some of these programs that we believe that are really important to our students, and if the cost of adding those across the state is very different to taxpayers, it is much more difficult for some districts to be able to offer the same kinds of services. So I'd like you to, first of all, look at the opportunity gap, the handout you have in front of you. And this is based on the annual tax burden or cost to a residential taxpayer if they were to fund a $1,500 per pupil referendum and if they lived in a $100,000 home. So across the state, if everybody lived in the same valued home and you wanted to go to your voters to pass a $1,500 levy, which is pretty significant, you can see that if you were in Senator Stump's district, it would cost the taxpayer $443. In South Washington County, which is my district, it would cost $622. In Stillwater, which is also part of my district, it's $182.
Excuse me, Senator Saltzman?
Yes.
As always, you are very prepared with a lot of handouts. We're going through them.
Okay.
We want to make sure we're referencing the same
document. It's the opportunity gap. It's where do you live? It looks like this. Okay, it's a one-pager. So, again, this is on a $1,500 levy. And if you're in Hopkins, which is Senator Bonhoeff's district, or in Orono, which is Senator Olson's district, it's $129 or $106. Now, if you were a taxpayer and you were going to go out and buy something and it was to get sort of the same thing, the same car, the same book, the same meal, and in one community it cost you $106, but in another community for basically the same thing it costs $443, you as a consumer might say, I'm not going to pay the $443. It's too much for me. And so this is where equalization comes in. And if we were truly using these operating levies for sorts of excess things, it might be one issue. But the fact that across the state we see that many districts are using these for the same kinds of programs, the same kind of needs, it really is an issue of fairness to not only taxpayers but to our students. There's another sheet that looks like this. It's a chart. It has all the school districts on it. And this is the actual tax impact on a $100,000 home to actually fund the operating levies in different communities. And the pages are not numbered, but I would like to go to, I think it's the fourth page from the back. And again, you can see Senator Stump's district, and he's not here, but his referendum right now for Amrosa, which is the third from the bottom, School District 682, they have a $500 levy, and it costs their taxpayers in a $100,000 home $105. If you move up just a little bit, For $107, the taxpayers in Senator Olson's district can achieve a $1,500 levy, which is three times as much. So again, this isn't about one school district being better than the other or one set of taxpayers being more willing to invest in their students, but for the same kind of investment, school districts are able to receive different amounts. In my school district, which is South Washington County, on a $100,000 home, taxpayers are paying $197 to receive a $929 levy. In Minnetonka, Senator Bonoff's district, for $193 for less money, they can achieve twice that at $1,851. So I think I've tried to make my point of what the problem is, but now I want you to understand how equalization works. Is imagine if there were two cups of there are two empty glasses in front of you, and if everyone in, you know, community A and then community B put the same taxpayer effort in to fill those glasses, because we need to fill them to the top to achieve the same levy amount. And as you fill one glass and everybody puts the same amount of money in, it's half full. In another community, everybody puts the same amount in, but maybe there's more commercial properties, and so there's more people helping to fill the glass. It goes to the top. The way that equalization works is that the state puts in equalization dollars to fill the class to the top. So again, because we're responsible for making sure that every student has a high-quality education, equalization is a way for the state to share the burden, to share the investment in education. And obviously, we understand that different communities have the right to go to their voters and ask them to support education with these operating levies. If there's a way for us to make it more fair, so that for taxpayers who are making the same effort can realize and capture the same amount of investment in their schools, that's what this is all about. It's never going to be completely a level playing field, but I think if we look at this at these times where we are relying on levies, that's very important. So Mr. Porter is here from the South Washington County Schools, superintendent there. I appreciate him coming back. And maybe share a little bit from South Washington County. And then Mr. Lindell is here with Schools for Equity and Education, and he can bury you in charts and graphs. But I think we just want to be able to present the case. And certainly there is a significant fiscal note on this. But there's also a way for us, I think, that when we've seen Senator Stump's consolidated levy, this was also a very important attempt to be able to look at how we can equalize and make our school funding formulas much more fair. And Senator Stump is here, and I'm sure Mr. Nauman will point out to him some of the figures I just shared. So,
welcome, Mr. Porter and Mr. Lindell. Please proceed, Mr. Porter.
Thank you, Chairman Stump and members of the committee, for giving me the opportunity to share briefly with you some of the impact that equalization has on the South Washington County schools. I am the superintendent there. It's a district of approximately 17,000 students on the southeast corner of the metro area, and is one that would be described as being of low property wealth in terms of commercial and business property. And to be honest, at present, I am not the poster child for this. We are currently doing very well in the South Washington County schools. We're very pleased with the way in which our voters have supported us. But in the very near future, it's obvious that we will have to continue to rely upon local voter-approved levies to sustain and maintain our programming, as we are as aware as you are of the challenges that lie ahead for the state in terms of their revenues. And we are doing, I think, exactly what the legislature expects us to do, which is to continue to prepare learners for the 21st century. And we are doing many things on behalf of our students. And I'm very concerned that without equalization, that we will not be able to sustain many of those efforts into the future. All right, one of the materials, in addition to all the numbers, even though I am a math teacher by trade initially, I find some of the graphs to be more exemplary for me. And there's a line graph at one time that illustrates the disparity between the 5th and the 95th percentile in terms of the revenue that's available to schools. And since 2003, as equalization has become what I would describe as increasingly ineffective, that gap continues to grow with alarming magnitude as we look at the variation that exists. And while we use numbers to compare one district to the other, this is not pitting one district against another. This is not suggesting that we should close that gap by moving the top down. It's simply asking to level the playing field so that we can continue to try to seek all districts to be funded on an equitable basis. And right now, that's, as has been pointed out, is very challenging in some districts to go back and have your voters approve levies that will cost them 3 to 4 times as much in order to try to attain the same level of revenue. Again, I think there are others of my colleagues who are probably suffering more greatly at this time, but I think they're probably so busy fighting battles over 4 period days and other kinds of things that they perhaps can't be here. But I'm concerned about the future for the students and the families in the South Washington County Schools.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell with Schools for Equity and Education. I really want to thank Senator Saltzman for introducing this bill and also for the chairman to schedule it. We know, given the price tag of $300+ million, that unless we strike oil underneath this building in the next 5 minutes, we're probably not going to be able to fund this year. But I think that, as I am usually wont to do, we'll talk a little bit about history. And in 1991, when referendum and debt equalization were established by the legislature and approved by the governor, 1991 for referendum equalization, 1992 for the debt service equalization. At that time, about between 50% and 60% of the districts in the state had referenda. Now, 90% of the districts in the state have referenda, and that's largely attributable to equalization. I think that there's we can talk about, and I'm readily and be candid about it, the strategy that this organization took at that time to pursue referendum equalization as the means to closing gaps between high and low spending districts. Is open to question and is debatable. I mean, should we be improving an imperfect something that will be ultimately imperfect in remedying that gap? But I think that's the game in which we're playing right now, and that's the world in which we live in. And I think that was exacerbated greatly in 2001 with the general ed takeover by then Governor Ventura as part of his big plan. We eliminated the general ed levy and really pushed the achievement or pushed the addressing of the gap over to an optional levy that would be approved by voters. And that has been, it's been problematic. We've had two recessions since 2001, right after 9/11, and then also the one that we're in right now. The excess levy, as Senator Saltzman said, is no longer an excess levy. It's going to the heart of school district operations, and to have in any reform package that we talk about, we have to have taxpayer fairness as part of that solution. And I think that when we talk about the things that have happened in 2001 and 2005, the grandfather districts, those districts above the cap, did receive upward adjustments to their ability, and they've used that ability. And also in 2005, there was an increase in the cap of about 50% from 18.6% to 26.8% of the general ed amount. And all the time while this has been going on, the equalizing factors have remained the same. So the purchasing power in low property wealth districts has dwindled, and property taxpayers are paying more. And now that in case of Mr. Porter, Dr. Porter, he's going to be going off equalization in the next couple of years as that amount stays at $476,000 per pupil. With him at 476, or if he gets up to $500,000, as we've talked about, some of the districts in the state have property wealth in excess of $1 million per pupil. That means when he's off equalization, he will be paying twice as much, or his taxpayers will be paying twice as much for the same dollar. And then that's problematic to us in Schools for Equity and Education. I think given the development patterns, the economic development patterns that have occurred in this state largely follow the 494 ring, and it's very, very difficult given the way we're going to a service economy now. These districts are never going to be able to develop the property tax base that other districts could develop in earlier times. And I think that's something that's very important to keep in mind here, is that there's one of the old arguments is, well, we developed in our school district. It's not our fault that you didn't. Well, again, that's the 1950s economy when a lot of those commercial and industrial enterprises were located in those districts. And the other simple fact of the matter is industrial property is worth far more than commercial property. I mean, commercial property is simply doesn't generate the kinds of wealth that are going to augment a tax base the way that industrial property will. And the industrial property, again, is given the way that that is, has developed is we're out of that economy now. We're no longer going to be having large industrial developments and certainly not in districts that are, you know, if not in the middle of nowhere, not as close to the kinds of transportation networks that need to be there for industrial property. So I think nationally that puts us, one of the things I've watched nationally is that in Minnesota, and this is talks about, and I think Senator Olson and I have talked about this over the years, one of the problems we've had is that the 1950s model of how we assess commercial property and industrial property in the state really gave a huge advantage in adjusted net tax capacity and a burden to those property taxpayers that probably should be revisited at some juncture. And that has created, that's really where the genesis of a lot of these problems come from. And in Minnesota, we have high wealth districts because of the location of this property adjacent to low wealth districts. I mean, you look at, I use the example of Wayzata and Rockford. I mean, Rockford's in Wright County and Hennepin County, and their property wealth is half of what it is in Wayzata, and why is that? Again, development patterns, and Wayzata's at the kind of the end of the I-94. Or I-394 and Rockford just north of that. But you'll see that, I think, in Minnesota more than in any other state, I see this real problem of districts of greatly disparate wealth right next to each other. And that's something that I think we have to look at and remedy. You know, really what it boils down to is we have to get back to, and I think we've talked about this in this body and we've talked about it over in the House as well, is the need for comprehensive funding reform that's going to put the excess levy back in its place. But the excess levy is always going to be part of the system, and voters should have a relatively equal chance to access those dollars as they work to improve the educational opportunities in their schools. This is not, as Dr. Porter said, a slap at those districts that have high property wealth. They have had advantages. They've used them well. They've built exemplary programs. Many of the low-wealth districts in the state would also enjoy the opportunity with the state assistance by treating taxpayers equally district to district to make those same decisions if they so choose. With that, I'll stand for any questions.
Senator Salzman.
Aaron, just to add, there is another chart here that's a bar graph, and it talks about the statewide referendum market value growth. And we have had equalization for many years in our state, and as districts are, as we say, falling off of it because market values are going up, people would say, well, isn't that great? You know, because you have greater market wealth, but it's going on across the state. Everyone is going up. And so we're basically falling off the formula. And when I talk to my community and say that we're a low property wealth community, people sort of are taken aback. Well, I live in Woodbury. I live in Prior Lake. I live here. I live there. But the issue is that it really has to do with sometimes the mix, and as Mr. Perr and I were just, discussing, is that sometimes school districts don't have control over where cities develop or where people move. Or within a community, again, we look at where we built our freeway system. And that, many times people say, well, we have greater, businesses in our community, but, I'm probably using the businesses there. Insurance companies are based somewhere. So, again, I think it's something where as we have a larger discussion about how we fund our schools and as we will be relying on our operating levies and the fact that this will have an impact on these levies being renewed, that as, properties are changing and people are looking at where can I say no? It's on our operating levies. And when one community has to pay even 70% more, in my community, I'm split between Stillwater and South Washington County, they're paying almost like 90% difference. And yet at the same time, compared to other communities, Stillwater's paying 70% more than another district. This is where some communities, it will be harder and harder to pass a levy for the same amount of investment in a student's education. So Whether it's equalization, Mr. Chair, or there's other ways to level the playing field, I think it's a very important discussion. And I know before that you stepped out for a little while, I did point out that even at this table, again, this isn't about pitting one district against another. Absolutely not. It's just to be able to educate all of us that those students who live in Roseau today may be the person who invents the next great thing for Minnesota. And so we want to make sure that that student, whether they're in Roseau or Thief River Falls or Edina or Eden Prairie, we all make sure that they have the same access to the same kind of taxpayer investment.
Senator Hand, excuse me, Senator Hand, I believe Mr. Lundell had a
Mr. Chair, I guess the other handout that I'd really think people need to look at or would be very instructive is the one that says referendum equalization is the percentage of total referendum revenue. And as you can see, back in Pay 96, that was, referenda at that time was, $308 million, and the equalization aid was $117 million. And so aid as a percentage of revenue was 38%. We've increased that by almost $500 million, and the amount of aid has decreased by $50 million. So we're now at 8% of the total referendum revenue is equalization. And that's directly attributable to the property values, the property value increases below the cap. And if you look at Pay 2000, you'll see where the referendum went down from Pay 2002 to Pay 2003. That was Governor Ventura's the big plan and the 415 roll-in as a result of that. But look how fast the referendum has grown throughout the decade, adding, again, a little over $500 million of referenda. And as we see then as well, 15 percentage point drop in the amount of that referendum revenue that's paid through aid.
Okay, Senator Hand.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Saltzman, and Mr. Porter and Mr. Lundell. I appreciate the discussion here. I have to say that I've been in a lot of budget discussions over the years, not only at the school district level, but in the private sector, and that's what we're having here today, and we're talking about funding, but. And I'm looking at your chart here, which is an interesting chart, but the one thing that's missing from this chart is the current revenues that are expended per pupil in each of the districts as well. And I think we need to know that. I think this is a piece of the funding formula, and you're making an argument that it is not equitable, which it truly isn't equitable, but I don't think funding is equitable across the state on any dimension. And I think that if we're going to assess this, we ought to have in addition, we ought to have the per pupil revenues for every student in all the districts. But beyond that, and I guess Mr. Lundell or Mr. Porter, what is the relationship between funding and student academic achievement? The argument is that we don't have equitable funding. We certainly don't have equitable results. And so what is the relationship of putting more funding in, whether it's through equalization or something else, and what is the result of that? Do you have data that would give us an idea of what making this investment might lead to in terms of achievement?
If I may, Chairman Stump, Senator
Superintendent.
Hunt. I think, obviously everyone would probably like to find, such data, but there are so many factors that contribute towards student achievement. We currently designate additional revenues to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and similar types of districts in recognition of the unique challenges that are faced there. And I think the challenges are unique across all districts. So it's very difficult to try to measure the direct correlation between pupil expenditures and student achievement without some type of a way of measuring and balancing some of the demographic differences as well.
Well, and Mr. Chairman,
Senator Hand,
and Mr. Porter, and I appreciate that. I think that's true. There's certainly great demographic differences across the state and across districts and all kinds of things that factor into that. But we have an education system that is intended to educate students, and we're asked to spend money, and there ought to be some relationship between what we spend and what we achieve. And it's frustrating for me when we talk about the budget and we talk about the money as if it's an entity in and of itself, and it ought to be dealt with independent of what it accomplishes. And it's not just in this discussion, but we've had other discussions along the same line where we talk about money and the need for more of it, but we don't have any relationship established between the spending of that money and accomplishing of any particular goal.
Now, a couple of years ago, I did do an assessment of every district in the state and the level of total revenue that they spend per pupil and the statewide test scores. You know what? It's a curve. It's a trend line, and it goes down. The higher spending districts have lower test scores. Now, I'm not saying that that causes that, but it was clear to me there's no relationship that I could detect. And I think until we find some way, and I agree with you, it's not easy, but that should be what we should be about in this committee, is to find out how we take the monies that we have and make them effective. This is a new world. People talk about this. And Mr. Lundell, you're talking about, you know, properties and the values, and you're right. Those things have changed, and they're not going to change dramatically. But we can't operate under the same old models either. We can't say, well, we're just going to keep putting money in the machine and turning the crank because every year the contracts go up or every year the costs go up. You got to find a way to do more with the monies that we have, and we don't talk about that. We just talk about the money as if it's an independent thing, that if we do better on it, that's going to have some effect, but we don't talk about how we get there. And so I'm frustrated, I'll admit that, and I think that we ought to work at trying to find the relationship between the monies that we're asked to put in and what we're going to achieve by doing that.
Well, Mr. Hand, I think it's difficult at individual district level, but I think we do assess at a much, you know, larger level at the state level, and you know, Minnesota has consistently had or been one of the top leaders in SAT scores, college entrance tests. A few years ago, we funded that TIMSS report and came back that we were, you know, in certain, I think they assessed two grade levels. We were extremely competitive across the world. So I think at a level that would kind of look at more general assessment, we do very well in Minnesota. I think where we have difficulty is when we kind of take the microscope and kind of look down at individual districts. I guess I would kind of turn it around and say, I think you have to have resources to provide opportunity, and then, hopefully the districts take that resource and do provide opportunity. I think I have some of the highest spending districts per pupil of anybody in the state of Minnesota, but that's not a result of those students having huge opportunities. It's a result of having very small schools. You know, they have basically gone out and taxed themselves, you know, to raise that revenue. And, the one in here I was looking at was Kitson County. And, you know, almost as long as I've been in the legislature, they've been never on a formula because the land up there is very rich agricultural land. But they're, I think, the highest, one of the highest. And then I suppose Red Lake would be kind of right next to it. And they have no taxable value, or maybe just one piece. Well, so let me summarize the problems of assessment as you dig down get very tenuous. I mean, very difficult. But I do, you know, I disagree that we don't have a good education system. I think we have problems in certain areas. Of course, the gap. The learning gap is one of them, but I think we can, given some help from the federal government with No Child Left Behind, I think that can help us zero in more precisely and put resources like yesterday on those community schools.
Community-centered education.
Yeah, where I think you can actually get right at the problem and help change that around and maybe over a few years turn that around. Senator Hand.
But and yes, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. And I think if you look at, and I don't recall, but probably Kitson County has, I think the gentleman the other day was talking about something, what, 94% graduation rates, pretty good results. And I'm not saying, and I haven't said, that we don't have a good education system. We do when you look at it in aggregate. And that's been, frankly, one of the things that a few years ago we recognized as a problem. When you look at things in aggregate, we do pretty well. But it's when you look at how we perform, when you look at the achievement gap between minority students or lower-income students, and it's not good. And we have one of the biggest gaps in the country. And the frustration is that we do spend a lot of money. And how well do we spend that money? For me, this is not purely a function of how much money we put into the system. That, to me, is not the thing that makes the difference. And that's part of my point here, is that we should talk about money, obviously, but we should talk about how we're using the money, how that money gets used to do the things that we think are important. We've talked a lot about achievement gap, a lot about those things, but we haven't yet found ways, and we know there are parts of the formula that are in place but have very little relationship to what is actually going on in the classroom to make the achievement gap get better or go away or accomplish those things. And so my point largely is, let's not get so tied up into making sure the money is equal or that there is an X dollar more money coming in. We need to find ways to make sure it's being spent effectively. And going back to my experience in the private sector, when we would talk about budgets, it wouldn't be a discussion of how much money this particular division or that particular division is going to get. It was always focused on, what are you going to do with it? What are you going to accomplish with this money? And if you can't show that you're going to do something positive, then there was a real question of what they should have anymore. Now, we don't do that in education. I'm not saying we should, but we should be talking about how the increase in funding is going to have an impact in achievement. And if it isn't going to do that, then we ought to question whether we should spend more money.
Mr. Chair? That's all.
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chairman, you're triggering, I know this is straying a little bit, but it's getting at that same point. Yeah, I was kind of surprised yesterday in reading in the paper the questioning of whether, quote, we could afford to go to an hour-based, our instructional hours over what we have in the governor's recommendation to go to hours in student contact time, essentially, versus the days. And I had never really thought about that how much difference there might be out there among districts. We're delivering money on a per pupil basis. And I've brought it up many times. What are we getting for what we're spending? I don't know if there's a way of tracking that. Have we a way of knowing by district, at grade level or at the level of education, what the hours of student contact time are? Because I think that's one thing we know, that the more instructional time and student contact time you have, generally the better results that you can get. But what is that differential? Has anybody ever done anything like that, or is that kind of data available to us that we could see? And then you can compare with the achievement. Is it making any difference what level that they are performing at? I think we ought to take advantage of, the challenging this, or even whether to make that policy decision as to what we're, what kind of results we're getting with the amount of student contact time and the differential between districts. Are you tracking with me?
Yes, I think the department has found different areas too. I mean, that was one of the governor's proposals to make some changes. And I think the difficulty that we struggle with, it's kind of like the twins. They pay a fairly high price for some individuals like Joe Nathan and then his arm goes out. And so it's not always a for sure investment, when you put money into something that you're going to have the results. And humans are that way. I mean, we all act differently. We think we have theories of how people learn or get educated. And it's not, I mean, like you and Senator Saltzman worked on the reading program. I mean, here you had all these professionals in colleges and universities developed this approach on how all these students were going to learn how to read, and somebody discovered that maybe wasn't the best approach. And so what works sometimes in one place doesn't always work in another.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I haven't had a chance to read today's paper, but there's an article on that subject today, so maybe that about our efforts to try to assure that teachers are equipped with a variety of methods. It's still going to boil, a lot of it is going to boil back to the teacher and the amount of time that they have in contact with the student. And if they're well prepared, I think we're going to have, you know, we're going to see results. And if they're missing out on that, we need to keep at that.
Senator, Senator Saltzman, Senator Michelle, and Senator Bonhoff.
There. Well, thank you, sir. I just want to, if we could bring this back and talk about, and I love the discussion. It's a good discussion, but I think when we talk about funding, this bill is really about taxpayer equity and equal opportunity. That, you know, Senator Hand, I think we can have a really good debate on where those investments, how much one school is getting, and those are, I think, are formula-driven. So when I look at this, I think it's a different discussion because this isn't going into, this is really about the operating levy and about how one community has to spend three times as much. I think that your taxpayers, if we said, you know, there's two textbooks here, there's a math book, and you want to institute the new math program. And in one community, it's going to cost you, you know, your taxpayers $400. And over here, the textbook's going to cost $108. People are going to say, well, we all want the same math book. Why is it going to cost one community so much more? It's because of this formula that we've created. And I do want to note, Senator Hand, one more thing, is that in today's Star Tribune, it does talk about the achievement gap. And Mike Savage from Eden Prairie Schools is quoted in there because he is using, it's not about more money in his school, it's about what they're doing and the amazing results that they're having with these Somali kids because they're using scientifically based researched intervention. And that was a good thing. So, I mean, we talk about that is, it's not just about maybe more of the same. We may need additional resources. I will have that discussion. But then we also have to have the discussion of maybe we also need to do things differently. So that's another discussion. But I think with this bill, it is about taxpayer equity. And again, it's not all formulas. We're really focusing on the operating levy here. So,
Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know Senator Saltzman wants to bring us back, but I just wanted to comment on some of the materials. So maybe it's more for Mr. Lundell, but I don't think it's going to serve your cause the best to put together some of these materials. The one I'm particularly looking at is the opportunity gap, where you attach a number, a dollar figure to certain districts, you know, I know you're trying to make a point here, and you're going to understand why I'm sensitive to the point, but, you know, Senator Latz and I will take you on a tour of a Hopkins school building, and you will see crowded classrooms and staffs that are stretched and great teachers that are underpaid, and I just can't think of what that experience would be like for the three of us if we did that and then put it into your analysis here that in some ways Hopkins students are getting more opportunity than some of these districts on the bottom of the page. So I really want to suggest that we not get into this kind of geographical comparison, because I think it just automatically turns some people one way or another, and I think it's been a good discussion here. I appreciate what Senator Hann and Senator Stumpf were saying, but boy, I would not describe it as an opportunity gap based on where you live, and I'd just be really careful with using that language and those numbers in that way.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Michelle,
Mr. Lundell.
That's probably our most incendiary piece. So. But I think the other. You know, I represent 58 school districts, and just say a lot of times I'm the calmest person in the room. And
so am I.
Right. And I think that, and I agree that I think you know, a beggar thy neighbor approach here is probably not the way to go. And we've worked closely with AMSD. We've worked closely with MREA on the New Minnesota Miracle. I think what Senator Hand and certainly want to pick up on that is what set of opportunities exist. I think that, and I'm sure that a lot of Hopkins schools look exactly or look similar to school districts in Anoka-Hennepin, where you've got, you know, 40, 45 kids in a classroom, those types of things. To get to one of his, you know, just was in the case of Senator Hand with achievement, and Senator Michelle, I guess the thing is that a lot of this boils down to the menu of opportunities that are in front of children. And I think that we work with a lot of school districts or schools for equity education that have one foreign language. And that's not going to get kids prepared for the new global economy. We need to find ways to do that, and maybe there's ways to do that across districts or through with interactive television or through online. Those types of non, you know, kind of new ways of looking at doing business are there. But clearly the opportunities, and maybe opportunity gap's the wrong term, and maybe it does when you start to cast stones across the river, it doesn't seem it can be counterproductive. I guess the point we're trying to make is that in Senator Phoebe's district, I think of, is one that is really not where kids just aren't getting what they are in other parts of the state.
Okay, Senator Bonhoff, and then I'd really like to move forward. Senator Phoebe?
Yes.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do concur, because I know we're done at 10, and we're down to the final wire here. So just briefly, Mr. Lundell, you did reference PS Minnesota, and I see you're kind of sitting here all by yourself out there, and I wonder, does your group support what you're bringing forward today?
Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, I think that the PS Minnesota, PS Minnesota does call for full equalization of all levies. The House bill that kind of sprung from PS Minnesota is, you know, contains some equalization improvements, but not to this level of improvement.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lundell, as I understand it, kind of the tenuous marriage of the group depended on a balanced approach in which each of the areas that had their issues were kind of dealt with. So we had the equalization, we had the LEI, we have the sparsity, all of those things. And so I'm a little bit surprised, I'm not sure that this is the most balanced approach. And then finally, wouldn't you think it might be best for everybody, if there were money, which obviously there isn't this year, to put it on the aid side so that we move towards having less reliance on referendum and more balance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, we came forward with this bill this year not with any hopes of it passing. I mean, you see the price tag on this bill. We want, I guess what we're trying to accomplish and what Senator Saltzman is trying to accomplish and Schools and for Equity and Education is trying to accomplish is the fact that the property tax differentials are now reaching what we think is a critical stage and need to be discussed.
Okay.
If you clearly, this is where I'll join with Senator Hand wholeheartedly. We need to look at everything we do. And we need to look at the way we organize. We need to look at everything. But at the bottom line of that readjustment of how we do business, and I think your shared services plays into this as well, taxpayer equity has to be, you know, foremost in that, a prominent part of that discussion. Does that mean equal dollars for equal kids? No. Some communities are going to want to do more, should be able to do more to some extent, but the basis upon which those decisions are made should be more equal than the basis that is currently enjoyed.
Okay. We have Senator Phoebe, then we have Senator Saltzman's amendment to the proposal, and then we should take action. We only have a half hour left.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saltzman, I just want to thank you for bringing this forward. I had many of these same charts in front of myself when I worked with the Elk River situation this year, and I think this, the key for me is the focus on the burden on each individual taxpayer and the inequities in the state. Yes, we have to have the comprehensive discussion, but all 11 of my school districts are so tipped negatively with what they pay per dollar with other districts in the state. So I think the focus is our constituents and our taxpayers in the state. So thank you.
Senator Salzman.
Yes, I'd like to move the amendment, Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment.
Okay, Senator Salzman moves the A1 amendment. And members, I believe it, if you look on page 2, that's the basically lines 4, 5, and lines 14. And if you could just give a six-word,
there's just a technical correction, Mr. Chair. Okay. It's just some of the numbering. To clarify, there was a language correction. I guess I would say it's not a major correction in the intent of the bill.
A1.
The A1, yes.
A1 amendment. Dr. McClay.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment addresses repetition of what the referendum equalization allowance is. It's stated what the referendum allowance is in a later paragraph, and so we don't need that paragraph E.
Mr. Chair, I believe we put it on initially as an author's amendment. Chair, did you put it on?
Yeah. I don't think so.
No.
Okay. On Senator Salzman's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Senator Hand, very, very briefly.
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair, I just had one further comment to add to the discussion here, and maybe we need to get this date in front of the committee, but Minnesota has, at the state level, we pay for 70%, over 70% of all the costs of public education, K-12, come from state general fund sources, which is the second highest percentage of any state in the country. The only higher one is Arkansas. And so when we talk about equalization, I think what we're talking about is increasing the burden on the state general fund to pay school costs. And we are already, the average across the country is 46%, so we're way above that. And so when we talk about equalization, where do the equalization dollars come from? They're going to come from income taxes. And who pays the income taxes? It's going to be the people in some of the districts that have right now high property value, maybe. So it's money's going to come from somewhere, and the question is whether or not having it come from state general fund is better than what happens in most places across the country. And I just think that we ought to be aware of the big picture when we talk about equalization, and also, in my opinion, it's not just about money. And so I share that with you, Mr. Lundell, that we need to look at how we use it.
We understand the issues, and I think that it might, with in light of the budget that we're dealing with, I think the discussion is good to have and everything, but I think it would be good motion to recommend that without a recommendation that this be laid on the table for possible inclusion.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, that would be perfectly fine with me to move that.
Senator Salzman moves that Senate File 2384 as amended be laid on the table for possible inclusion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion
thank
is
adopted. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
And thank you very much for your testimony and information. We have Senator Latz here, and we could as Senator Latz is coming forward. Well, Senator Latz, welcome. Senate File 3008. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This proposal is to change or to add a provision to authorized expenditures of operating capital revenue to include school closing costs. It arises specifically out of St. Louis Park School District's experience this year in which they are right-sizing the physical infrastructure for the district, resulting in the closure of three facilities but one elementary school. They are specifically seeking to be able to use their operating capital revenue to pay for the cost of closing Cedar Manor Elementary School. That's a cost of about $225,000. Now, St. Louis Park School District has a budget of about $44 million. This year, they're going to be cutting $1 million out of that budget. Next year, they expect to cut $2 million, and the following year, they expect to cut another $2 million. So the ability to use $225,000 out of this silo of money would be very significant in helping my community deal with this budget situation. I will. Sometimes it's helpful to actually take a look back at the statute, and that's what I did in preparation for this hearing. And I would note that current permissible uses for the operating capital revenue is to buy land for school purposes, to buy buildings or to build buildings for school purposes, to rent or lease buildings, to repair and improve those buildings, to equip those buildings, including with libraries, to eliminate barriers for disability, to bring it into compliance with state fire code, to remove asbestos, to pay for the costs of setting up heating fuel and transportation fuel storage or removal, energy audits, loan to pay principal and interest on loans for energy conservation, to buy or lease interactive telecommunications equipment, to pay for the staffing for that, to purchase or lease computers, assistive technology, to buy textbooks, to buy vehicles, library and media resources and technology. So it just seems that one of the most basic costs associated with physical infrastructure, the closing of buildings, would be naturally included in this list, more naturally included than some of the other items that I've just identified. I would also note parenthetically, our school district, the St. Louis Park community, is made up probably a majority of immediately post-World War II housing. Probably the average square footage is about 1,500 square feet, somewhere in that range. And we have never failed to pass an operating referendum levy, certainly not in my memory. So the tax effort of the people in my community is very strong, very committed to education. We've only got about 15% of our community has kids in the schools. So you can see how committed the community is. But when it comes to having to close a building like this, it's wrenching enough for the community with having to redraw the lines. And in fact, they're changing even the grade levels throughout the school district. An extra $225,000 that they can take out of this silo of funds would make a really big difference for my community, and I'd appreciate your support. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Michelle?
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, my wife used to teach at in the school district at the Hobart Elementary School, so I'm guessing they're going to get some of these kids from the closing. But do you have more details on what are the costs, the specific costs, can you run them down, of closing a building? This is unfortunately something we're going to probably have to talk about in a number of school districts. And so the figure you're using is 225, right?
Yes.
Senator Lapp.
I think for many people, they think, oh, well, closing a building saves you money, right? You don't have to pay to turn on the lights anymore. So do you have any more detail on the costs themselves?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Michelle, I don't have any specific detail. I know that, there's going to be some holding costs with the building. It doesn't have any immediate use. There will be some costs preparing the building for sale if that's what the school district decides to do. But beyond that, I couldn't tell you what specifically those costs are. Our original estimate was $200,000 to $300,000, and this morning we got the school district's specific estimate of the cost of $225,000. In the long run, certainly, it will save the school district money because you'll be able to consolidate staff as well, and it'll save on transportation costs. You'll have one less facility to bus people to, as well as the long-term operating maintenance costs. You won't have to heat up whole building, during the winter. But the other specific costs involved in closing, I couldn't tell you.
And Mr. Chair, just one follow-up, and you alluded to this. So the district does not have a formal plan yet as to if they're going to sell the building or rent it out. The future of this facility is not clear at this time.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Michelle, the final decision to close the building was made within the last couple weeks. So they don't have a specific plan that I'm aware of yet. They might inside the school district, but I'm not there. It is the land is well located. It's right at Cedar Lake Road and 169. So it's a good location. They could charge the kids to go sledding on their hill, which we do frequently, but I don't think they get too far with that.
Senator Bonham.
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, would it make more sense to just do a one-time exception and allow a fund transfer so that we're not changing the policy for, all schools based on a particular situation for St. Louis Park?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, in terms of the practical effect, it makes no difference to me.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, that would be fine with you if we authorized a one-time fund transfer in that amount.
That would, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, yes, that'd be fine.
Senator Ron.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, there are a lot of schools that are going through this right now.
Right.
So I think Senator Latz has brought forward something that is quite legitimate. And many school districts across the state are facing these closings, and there are costs associated. So I would resist making this that specific.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chairman, I do think, in response to Phil's question, the notion you've included in here, including moving and storage costs, and it does say directly associated, maybe as this does, wherever this goes here, we could get a little more information rather than what just automatically comes to mind, but obviously, there are costs that are associated with closing a building, and I wouldn't like to see it narrowly focused. I think Senator Romo is right that this is as legitimate. It's going to be needed by others, too, but it might be helpful if we did have a little better framework in our mind of what some of those tend to be. Do that.
Maybe, Senator Latz, you could check with the school board and just give us an idea what that, what they're including in those areas anyway.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, I can probably get that for you very promptly.
Senator Michelle, you want to move the...
If he doesn't, I will.
I will actually
cooperate. Senator Michelle moves it. I don't think there were any amendments, right? Okay. Senate File 3008 be recommended to be passed and laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus education bill. Anybody else that wants to say anything? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you,
Senator Latz. Next we have Senator Murphy. And then we have to go. Senator Murphy, very quickly, I think this should be a relatively easy bill.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nauman has worked on an E3 amendment to get this bill so that
Senator
it works.
Senator Wieger moves the A3 amendment. That's being handed out. Mr. Nauman, you want to explain?
So, Mr. Chairman and members, I believe the intent of the original bill was to lock in the amount. Well, I should back up perhaps a little bit because this bill didn't actually go through this committee. There was a, for lack of a better word, a disaster bill last year that Senator Murphy carried that dealt with some of the effects in the city and school district of the region of St. Charles associated with the fire that occurred down there. And as one of the things that we traditionally do in a circumstance where there's a unanticipated natural disaster or fire of this circumstance is provide school district pupil protection in that circumstance. And it was moving very quickly at the end of the session at the time, and this committee did not consider how the language of that pupil protection language was drafted. And so this bill, in part, clarifies some of that and conforms to some of the traditional practice that we use in making those calculations. But in addition to that, it's my understanding, maybe Senator Murphy wants to speak to this, that the intent here is to lock in the appropriation values for the school district. But if the pupil losses end up generating less amount, that the school district would be allowed to have that money transferred to the city of St. Charles, so the appropriation would be locked, and then the if the pupils ended up less, they could help benefit the city at the same time.
And we're talking about $50,000.
Well, Mr. Chair, that language, the fiscal note was prepared on the original bill, and I think that this would be a zero cost item now that the amendment has been added.
All right. So zero cost.
Mr. Chair, I think we ought to confirm that with the department, but I believe that that's the case. Right. We can work that.
Senator Olson moves the A3 amendment. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. And Senator Olson, you want to move the 2542 as amended?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson, or Senator Roland.
I'm still trying to figure out if the school district doesn't get the money because they don't have as many students that have left as was anticipated. Now the money will go for a grant to the city of St. Charles. And what are they going to do with the money?
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, you know, just to refresh your memory, you know, we had the floods down there the same month that the bridge fell down in Minneapolis. Wiped out a lot of the lower half of my district and Sharon Erickson Ropes portions of her district. And so there was a disaster aid bill at that time. The city of St. Charles was a beneficiary to that. Unfortunately, the very next year we had a fire that wiped out the largest employer, employed over 200 employees, many of which were employees of color. There was some drop-off because people moved to find jobs. There was some drop-off, but it was not nearly as much as we had anticipated in the school district, you know, kids going to school. But because of that fire, the city lost over $290,000 in utility payments just because of that fire. They're trying to develop about a 47-acre site. And St. Charles sits between Highway 14 and the interstate there. The city has, they acquired this piece of property a long time ago. They're developing the utilities and infrastructure there in hopes to bring some other businesses back. There's already been some activity there, and they expect to be up and running within 2 years. And this, you know, this $50,000, roughly, it doesn't sound like much, but it will help that project to continue. You know, these folks are just asking for a hand, you know, hand up a little bit here, and then they'll take care of everything on their own.
Okay. All right. Senator Olson moves that Senate File 2542 as amended be recommended to be laid on the table and possibly included in the omnibus education bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members.
Senator Bonhoff. Senator Bonhoff, I apologize that we have gotten, I think this is our second run at this. So.
Mr. Chair, yes. It's all right with me. I sit here, and I'm happy to be here. But Mr. Westrom, we appreciate, because he did sit through a whole hearing one day, and then I wanted to just make sure he got through again this time. So we're appreciative that you're here.
Senator Bonhoff, you have a A1 delete all amendment?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
That'll be handed out. And Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This delete all, originally we had done the bill to look at how Wayzata could participate in the alternative facilities program in a different manner, but then we came to find out that there were a couple districts in a similar situation to Wayzata some years back, and that there was a precedent for how they were dealt with. It was dealt with in session law, and it just allowed those two school districts, one of them was Senator Wieger's district, to be able to participate in the alternative facilities program. So this provision has been drafted consistent with prior practice. And with that, I would like to ask Mr. Westrom to talk about why Wayzata has found themselves just on the other side of being eligible and make his case.
On Senator Bonhoff's amendment, the A1 amendment, we'll get that on before the committee so that we have it. Senator Bonhoff moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Bonhoff.
Very good. Mr. Westrom.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about Senator Bonhoff's proposal to allow Wayzata to become eligible to participate in alternative facilities early eligibility. As you know, this will allow Wayzata to follow suit with some other exceptions that were granted to other districts in the past. Currently, we will qualify for alternative facilities in about 5 years when our buildings reach the required age and square feet requirements. Currently, we're at an average square footage of 1.6 million square feet and 30 years of age. Like other districts that have been sought and granted early eligibility, the reason why we're looking for this is primarily for four reasons. First, today's economic environment provides very favorable borrowing rates and bid environment for construction costs as well. We currently are doing some things to improve our energy efficiency and other things that are translating into direct savings to our taxpayers, and we believe that by becoming eligible for all facilities at this time, that will also provide some taxpayer benefits. Second, there is no financial impact for the state in this legislation. The funds for Wayzata's participation in the All Facilities Program would come entirely from local levy. Third, we are using a small portion of our general fund budget to do some of our maintenance projects within the school district. And this alternative facilities would allow us to more effectively manage our general fund budget. And finally, and most importantly, Wayzata's participation in the Alternative Facilities Program would not increase property taxes for our local residents. Currently, we levy about $3.1 million on an annual basis through the Alternative Facilities Health and Safety legislation and deferred maintenance revenue, which is a part of the formula. Both of these would be eliminated and rolled into the Alternative Facilities funding formulas per current statute. So, as I mentioned, existing $3 million levy amount would then be repurposed for the alternative facilities funding program that we are requesting today. The cost of the taxpayers would be the same, and we would be able to accelerate nearly $30 million worth of deferred maintenance projects that we currently are putting on the back burner until we become eligible for alternative facilities funding. So we believe that the passage of this legislation will represent a win-win situation for our district and for our community and for our taxpayers. We will be able to repair and maintain our facilities that are currently being deferred now instead of in 5 years when we become eligible for the program. So we would greatly appreciate your support of this legislation.
Hey, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Did we deal with this a year ago, or was it a discussion point? Or this looks familiar.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, I did bring it forward last year, but then I didn't know about having dealt with it in this way, so I just put forward a broad and changed actually the amount of years and the square footage requirements, and so then it became a big issue for the whole state, and it was a bigger fiscal implication. So this is coming at it from a very narrow perspective.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, Mr. Cook reminds me to remind the committee that Senator Rosen also had a bill that dealt with the same topic.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So from the sounds of your bill, you will be taking advantage of the lower costs right now to do the repairs. Did I hear you say you are also going to be doing some energy-saving remodeling, so you'll be saving some dollars in that manner, too?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rummel, we actually already are using some of our general fund dollars to do energy efficiency savings. We recently issued $5 million worth of bonds, and we received extremely competitive interest rates on that short-term borrowing, as well as we're going out for bids, and we're seeing very favorable bid results as well. Very competitive environment right now. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's no question there's a need for it for other districts as well, but the district here is will have to put together a 10-year plan that would be approved by the Department of Education. It would be vetted at the local level, approved by the school board. And so I just, while you're here, Mr. Westrom, I was wondering if you could comment on the opportunities for shared services with these facilities in addition to serving the district. Have you looked at additional ways to maximize taxpayer investment?
Mr. Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wenger, actually we cooperate quite a lot with our local city, the city of Plymouth. We share many of our facilities, and we share many of our athletic fields and other but we do cooperate quite a bit with our city. As a matter of fact, the public works departments, we find ourselves in a very unique and favorable situation where we actually, purchase fuel together and do other things to make sure that we're efficient and effective with our communities. Thank you. Thanks.
Senator Bonhoff, is there anyone else that would like to comment or anything?
Mr. Chairman, I've heard the case too, and I represent a good chunk of Wayzata School District and strongly support this move. It's kind of right at the edge, so I mean there is a gap before others, so it isn't taking a wild leap in this, and I think as we may want to look at the overall policy, but I think it's very justifiable to include Wayzata in this at this time.
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, members, I move that Senate File 433, as amended, be recommended to pass and for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. On Senator Bonhoff's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, members, we are going to recess until 6 p.m. Roughly, and then we have some fund transfers and then a proposal on special education third-party billing, and then Senator Bonhoff has a capital and education levies modification. Not sure. So it'll be here in this room, right after session. Committee is recessed.
Estimated.